So welcome to this evening's Mattingley Lecture. I'm Rebecca Lingwood, the Director of the Institute of Continuing Education here at Mattingley Hall. And first I'd like to take the opportunity to introduce our chair for tonight, Professor Martin Daunton, so that he then may introduce our speaker, Professor William Brown, and to chair questions at the end of the lecture. Martin Daunton previously taught at the University of Durham and University College London before moving to Cambridge in 1997. He was chairman of the Faculty of History and of the School of Humanities and Social Sciences before he was elected to the Mastership of Trinity Hall in 2004. Martin was president of the Royal Historical Society for 4 years from 2003 and a trustee of the National Maritime Museum for many years until 2010. He's currently a member of the Academics Awards Committee for the Leverhulme Trust, and this year he becomes head of the School of Humanities and Social Sciences. Martin continues to teach, write, and research in modern economic history. So before we get started and I hand over to Martin, could I remind you that if you have your mobile phones with you tonight, now's the moment to switch them off. So thank you, Martin.
Well, thank you, Rebecca, for that introduction. And it gives me great pleasure to introduce William Brown. As you have no doubt worked out, I'll be taking over from him as the head of the School of Humanities and Social Sciences, and a very hard act to follow it will be. William came to Cambridge in 1985 as the Montagu Burton Professor of Industrial Relations. He started his career back in that lost world, which my students in my lectures think is almost as distant as the Middle Ages, the 1960s, 1966. He became a researcher on the Prices and Incomes Board. And he went on then to head the Industrial Relations Research Unit at the University of Warwick before coming here to join us in Cambridge. Willie is an outstanding scholar who is also a great servant both of this university and of the wider world. Within this university in Cambridge, he's been chairman of the Faculty of Economics and also at present the head of the School of Humanities and Social Sciences, as well as since 2000, the Master of Darwin College. His other services in the university are legion. He served on various syndicates, both as a member and very often as chair. He's been the chairman of the Colleges Committee. He's been on the Press Syndicate, the Examination Syndicate, the Botanic Garden Syndicate, and the Board of Graduate Studies. I feel quite tired just listing all of these committees. But not only within Cambridge has he been so active, also outside Cambridge he's taken on wider public responsibilities that directly relate to tonight's lecture. He's been a member of the ACAS panel of arbitrators since 1985, a member of the Low Pay Commission from 1997 to 2007, chairman of the Fire Brigade's Resolution Advisory Panel, and many other services. I understand that he is currently advising the Chinese government on how to create trade unions, and a very interesting task, I believe, that is. Well, alas, Willie is retiring at the end of this academic year, retiring both from Darwin College and from the university. But I'm sure that his energy will continue unabated. He will continue to give great service both here in Cambridge and to the wider world. And we look forward to hearing his lecture tonight, which is on how might we protect the wages of the weak. Willie Brown.
Well, thank you very much, Rebecca, and thank you, Martin. As you will have gathered from Martin, I've spent all my time in Cambridge in an economics faculty. And if there's one thing that the economists should have learned from the past 5 or so years, it's the importance of economic history. So having a chair who's an economic historian is very good for me. Let me just work out how to... Yeah. This is a time of year when students suffer over exam questions, and it's usually a good idea to haven't take on an exam question where you know the answer. And here I'm at a disadvantage because I think it's a really interesting question and it's a huge challenge. But as you'll gather by the end, I really don't know what the answer will be. What I want to... The setting, as it were, is the problem of increasing inequality within societies and across the world, and the decline in what are generally known as labour standards, in other words, what people are paid, the hours they work, the working conditions, and so on. And the enormous threat that poses to democratic values. I had the privilege of becoming a grandparent about 2 months ago, and there's nothing like looking at a baby that size and wondering what her life is going to be like to make you realise that the stability of the society you live in is really of enormous importance. So what lies behind increasing inequalities? What are the remedies and what are the prospects? And I want to say a little bit about the traditional remedies, which are from what you might call the supply side, organising workers who produce and deliver services through collective bargaining, through trade unions. I want to say a little bit about what governments have done to deal with the problem of deepening inequality, in particular minimum wages. And most there's been a revival of interest in minimum wages throughout the world. It's a subject that first became important 100 years ago, but is now generally taking off again. And then I want to look at some more speculatively some of the new ways in which people are trying to address the problem of declining labour standards through what you might call the demand side, through the people who buy the services, buy the goods, the consumers, the governments, and so on. And then, as Martin said, I'm getting increasingly interested in China, because that's where our futures lie to an extraordinary extent. And so I want to end up with some raising some questions about, even if we can't protect collective bargaining in the West, what's happening to collective worker behaviour in the wider world? Well, generally, until the late 20th century, income inequality was diminishing. In Britain, for instance, the point of greatest equality was sometime in the 1970s, and it's been becoming more unequal since then. It's been becoming unequal in quite interesting ways at the moment. The top one percentile, you know, people like Martin Sorrell have been doing inordinately well, exploiting the market imperfections around those who actually control the rents, as it were. But the general picture is of inequality across the scale increasing. Worldwide, the picture was that richer countries were moving away from poorer countries until the end of the 20th century. What's been happening since then is much more complicated. The world has been becoming more unequal, but it's been becoming more unequal because the rich developing countries like India and China are developing. But internal inequality within those countries has been increasing. With the exception of Africa, which is a tragedy of its own, the rest of the world, in some sense, it's within society inequality, which is the challenge, rather than between nation inequality. The images I've got, wonderful picture, a painting by a man called von Herkimer. It's called On Strike, painted in 1892. Just at the time that what you might, looking back, see as the world strike wave really got underway. And the other picture is a girl in, I think she's in Nepal, but I don't know if any of you heard from our own correspondent last Saturday. There was a moving account of child stone breakers in Madagascar. She could be almost anywhere in the world. This is our century, and this is the other side of increasing inequality within countries. Now, as Martin said, I got into these things at a time when trade unions were seen to be a problem, strikes were a problem, and if you were a recent graduate in 1966, then that was what was exciting. Why were all these strikes? Who are these fiendish shop stewards who did things? This is a strike at a British Leyland plant, I think it's 1973. Very typical, and I spent the next 10 years of my life doing research on things like this, looking at the payment systems and the shop steward organisations. And there are all the dynamics that went on behind this extraordinary grassroots, very democratic process whereby very normal men and women had to deal with usually extraordinarily incompetent managements and completely bonkers payment systems, which if you set out to design something that created tensions and feelings of unfairness, you couldn't have done better. But the achievement of the trade union movement in the Western world in the 20th century was extraordinary. And because trade unions, in the cases of Britain, say, took part in creating political parties, in other cases got captured by or involved with political parties, in many countries, trade unions became involved with the government in power, and thus you got legislation that encouraged trade unions and encouraged legislative support for the agreements that they concluded and gave rights to strike and so on. And so we got a more equal society in the 20th century, and it wasn't through benign employer behaviour, it was through the use of power. Trade unions won a share of the profits, a share of the rents, by exploiting employer vulnerabilities. And the particular strategy they generally used throughout Europe and other countries as well was to organise workers across the whole of a product market, as it might all be all the carpet makers around Kidderminster or around Halifax, all the shipbuilding yards around Newcastle or wherever. And if you can organise all the workers across all the whole product market, then it's in the interests of the employers to go into an agreement. The phrase used was to take wages out of competition and reduce the probability of a strike. But you need to have credible strike action. And credible strike action doesn't mean that you just have a strike on one employer, because if you have a successful strike on one employer, the others will just rub their hands and take his market share. You've got to organise across the whole product market. Now, the benefits of this, again, at the time, I think people saw it as very troublesome and strikes, you've got doctors going on strike, sort of, tomorrow. The benefits are often neglected. But the impact on reducing inequality in the Western world was extraordinary. And there's all sorts of measures you can do to estimate what the impact of being a member of a trade union or being covered by a collective agreement, which is different, what sort of benefits that had for not just wages, but for working conditions, for rights at work, for dignity at work, the right to be able to stand up to an employer and have your opinion viewed with respect. And obviously that has led to great advantages in terms of social stability, and countries which have institutionalised this to a high degree, the Scandinavian countries, Austria, for example, Germany, have by and large ended up both being more equal and extremely economically successful. And they've been economically successful partly because if you force people to pay more for workers, they tend to treat them better, they value them more, but they're more likely to use labour-replacing technology. So it has an enormous dynamic effect on the sorts of technologies people develop. It's well known that slave-earning societies tend to be pretty primitive in terms of technology. Why have a fancy bit of machinery to make cloth or plough the land or whatever if you've got free slaves who you can just beat into line? Valuing labour, paying it more, generally has a very beneficial effect more generally. But this extraordinary achievement, looking back on it, an extraordinary sort of historical set of circumstances that made the 20th century into which I was born so amazing, really, in historical terms, it's collapsed in the private sector. And I'm going to talk mostly about the private sector because the public sector, to some extent, just follows on. In most countries, membership of trade unions has fallen dramatically. In Britain, if you just take private sector trade unions, then the percentage of workers in trade unions has fallen from about 50%, depending how you measure it and what you do with privatised industries and all those things, from about 50% 30 years ago to about 15% now. And the coverage of collective agreements, which are an enormous protection, you know, the people who aren't necessarily in trade unions, has collapsed from covering about 60% of private sector workers to covering about 17%. Britain has extraordinarily good data on these things because there's a regular survey carried out roughly every 5 or 8 years, which has been going since 1980, so we've got numbers on everything. Why did this collapse happen, not just in Britain but elsewhere? Well, internationalisation is the biggest single explanation. People could import whatever from outside. If you look back 30 years ago, about a quarter of all British manufactured goods consumed were imported. That's 30 years ago, a quarter. Now it's about two-thirds. And the figure's very similar for France or Germany or Spain or wherever. We've become a much more international economy. People buy from where's cheapest, and particularly the supermarket chains are international, and they buy from source from where's cheapest. And in addition, the number of people working in the world, in the capitalist world, has doubled since about 1980, whereas there would have been about 1.5 billion workers in the world, in some sense competing with each other. Now there are about 3 billion because they've been joined by the workforces of China to India to a large extent, the old Soviet bloc and so on. So there's more people competing to make things or do things in order to earn a living. And ownership has been massively internationalised. A small statistic, but the proportion of shares on the London Stock Exchange owned by people with addresses outside UK was 4% 30 years ago. Now it's well over 40%. The figures I saw last were 2006, I think, and that was 40%, and it's been rising. And it's not that international ownership is malevolent. It's just that international ownership owes no loyalty to any particular base. So naturally, if it's cheaper to produce some, construct clothes in Bangladesh than in Nuneaton, then that's where you go in the interests of your shareholders. There's something else that's happened, and it's much more evident just really in the very recent few years, which is that governments have become much more willing to erode the legislative support that was built up over 100 years behind collective agreements and behind trade unions. And one of the features of these austerity programmes at the European Union, in a way that really they don't seem to have learned anything from the previous depression, is that many of the austerity programmes being imposed on Greece or on Italy or on Portugal, for example, and it will roll on, involve the erosion of trade union rights, the cutting back on rights that have been won for workers in terms of unfair dismissal and so on. In America, you may or may not have been in touch with the rather extraordinary Scott Walker recall thing, the governor of Wisconsin, who tried to get trade unions de-recognized in the public sector in the once very union-strong state of Wisconsin. A reaction to this resulted in his being re-elected last week, anyway. But it's a reflection of the extreme antipathy to and undermining of trade unions in the United States. And then closer at home, Mr. Beecroft, who's been advising David Cameron, his proposals are in many ways eroding protections that have been built up, shifting the risk to the workers in ways that it had been reversing the achievements of the past. And who knows? I mean, if the government's re-elected, other than in a coalition, this sort of thing might be what we see happening. And then the final point is the blurring of the employment relationship. It used to be the case the employment relationship was very simple. You know, there was an employer and there was the employee who might or might not be full time, but 30 years ago mostly was full time. But now it's being blurred in many ways. Hugely more part-time workers, partly because of the fact that such a high proportion of the workforce is female and in service operations. We have zero contracts, we have open hour, ended contracts, which is what actually probably most of the people employed in this room are on. All sorts of casual contracts. But particularly interesting thing is the subcontracting out, the outsourcing. For instance, British prisons, about 15% of British prisons, or about 15% of 10% of prisoners, 15% of prisoners, are now privatised, and the government's trying to increase that by 10% a year, outsourcing the... and one could go through many examples of outsourcing, and offshoring, of course, you see with a lot of things like call centres going... And agency working, whereby people are ostensibly working for an agency who is then working for someone else, which is a very high proportion. There's also statistics I could give you, but we've got quite good data on what proportion of firms outsource major activities like doing the wages or catering or cleaning, which they didn't do 30 years ago, and it's a very substantial proportion. These workers here, I photographed them in a place packing veggies near Mani in the middle of the fens. They're, I think, mostly Lithuanian. At the time I took their picture and met them, they were almost all illegal immigrants living in King's Lynn in multiple housing. They were working for an agent in the agricultural business, it's called a gangmaster, and their job security was pretty awful. At that time, the minimum wage hadn't been invented, or it was just about to come in, so they weren't on brilliant pay either. But these are the citizens of the modern world in many ways, and increasingly the immediate employer actually isn't in a position to have any sort of free bargain with the worker, because the immediate employer is dependent upon a contract with a client. The immediate employer is just an agency. Now, these things have been common to the Western world, and these two little pictures, this shows strike pattern. They're both concerned with strike patterns. This one on the right is, the blue line is number of working days lost from 1893 to 2003, but actually there's very little change. It just goes on dead straight until 2011. And the red line is the actual number of strikes, which was very high in this period because nearly all strikes took place. Statistically, nearly all strikes took place in the mining industry where there were particular things about. And, of course, we had 1 to 2 million people working in the mines. And the main point is the rapid decline of strikes from about 1980 onwards. And it wasn't Mrs. Thatcher what did it. It was a worldwide phenomenon. What this picture is it's some ingenious American, I think, labour historian has added up newspaper reports of strikes. But she did it in a very systematic way, so I think it tells you something. But what it shows you, as I said, the on-strike chap, he's about there, 1892, or alternatively here. And from then you go through the 20th century with periods of very substantial strike activity. It's aggregating what is called metropolitan countries. It's what I think we'd now call OECD countries, the major countries of the developed world, between 1870 and 1996. But again, this is 1981, you see this rapid decline in strikes. So, these include both public and private sector strikes. But what's most dramatic, if you look at the data country by country, is the private sector where the strikes have diminished. And it's important because public sector pay generally follows on from private sector pay. In the case of Britain, we have review bodies that have direct linkages between private sector pay and public pay for doctors or nurses or soldiers or whoever. So if the private sector is weak, the public sector suffers, or the counterpart workers. And I think the critical thing is there's no prospect of any reversal unless we in some way move away from a globalised economy with all sorts of implications that might be, that would be absolutely horrific actually, then this particular problem won't go into reverse. So the challenge facing my granddaughter, I reckon, is are we going to exchange something that was really rather unruly? And this is probably the Orgreave coal miners dispute, the Orgreave episode in 1984, which is probably the most extreme Labour discontent episode of my lifetime. Are we going to exchange this, which, yes, it could be unruly, but then that's the exercise of power, and it's negotiable. There were leaders. Arthur Scargill was a pretty useless leader, but it ended in a negotiation, and people went on. Or people, is it going to move to the streets, to processes beyond political reach? I was in Barcelona last autumn and came across this group of people demonstrating that they didn't really like capitalism very much. This was, in a sense, just a holiday snap. But, of course, this will grow. It will grow in Greece, it will grow in Spain. And who knows, when politics moves to the streets and has no articulate voice, then it's profoundly threatening, as our parents, or my parents' generation, discovered. So, what are the other ways? What other ways might there be of upholding decent labour standards in the UK and across the world? One way of putting this, and perhaps in a rather perverse way, is to say, how can you stop the good employer being undercut by the bad employer? There's a way in which Winston Churchill put it when he argued for the minimum wage back in 1908. How do you protect the good employer from being undercut by the bad? Because most employers actually want to be seen to be being fair by their workers, because naturally you work together and you're part of each other's lives. But how can you do that when you're being undercut in the marketplace by someone who's being unscrupulous? Another way of putting it is, since there's no such thing as a free market and all markets are created by people, usually in their own self-interest if they can, how can you make the profits that come from scarce resources, market manipulation, or whatever, how can you make them redistributed in ways that are politically acceptable, in the way which, to an extraordinary extent, collective bargaining, with all the implied mutual hurt implied by having strikes, in the way in which collective bargaining did become not just acceptable in the 20th century, but an extraordinary mechanism behind the ending of apartheid in South Africa through COSATU, or behind the crumbling of communist power in Poland through Solidarność, or through the extraordinary role that trade unions played in most countries in the Second World War, certainly in Britain, and which is one of the reasons why they came out of the Second World War with commanding such respect from the wider society. Well, I'll say a little about direct intervention by the state, and then I'll say a little bit about intervention by consumers. Intervention by the state, the single clearest intervention that state can make is by introducing minimum wages and statutory intervention of minimum wages. As I've said, most countries are getting reactivating minimum wage activity, and certainly it's a big issue in China. It's been revived made more effective in Australia and so on. Britain was very late. They didn't introduce a statutory minimum wage until 1999, and that was because the trade unions had opposed it, by and large. They were afraid that it would undercut collective bargaining, but by that time they were just aware that collective bargaining had crumbled. These jolly folk are the Low Pay Commission in 2003, when they just settled the minimum wage for the next 2 years, or they won that way. We'd been locked up in a country house for a weekend and told not to come out till we'd agreed. And this is John Cridland, who's now director of the CBI, a Cambridge Economic graduate. This is Adair Turner, Cambridge History graduate, Adair Turner, head of the Financial Services Agency, who's the chair, Cambridge Economics and History graduate. And the others, three trade union people, three employer representatives, and two academics, David Metcalfe and myself. It was a social partnership process. You get these people together, you give them lots of data, you let them trundle around the country talking to whoever they want to talk to, and then you bang them up in a country house for a weekend and tell them not to come out without a number. And it works. And it's been very uncontroversial. Although people constantly go over the data to try and find some evidence that big losses of jobs might have resulted, so far there's no evidence that it's had any adverse impact upon employment whatsoever, which is great. And this is what a minimum wage does to an income distribution. This is the British income distribution. For those statistically inclined, that was what it was like before the minimum wage, or before people anticipated, because the minimum wage was announced, and the number was announced in 1998. It's a good log normal distribution, as it should be. 10 years later, more than 12 years later, it's bumped up. There are a few people down here still being picked up who they'll be on apprenticeships or there'll be particular circumstances, but the whole distribution has been banged up. And something of the order of 1 or 2 million people have got higher wages than they would otherwise have done. Another way of looking at it is like this. This is a more complicated diagram. These running across here is the distribution of the reflects the percentiles of the population. So these are the people 95% up from the bottom, and these are the people 5% up from the bottom, and that's the median. And what it shows is how much their pay rises over a period have varied from the median. And the red line indicates the period running up to 1997, which is when the next year, that was when the minimum wage began to have an anticipatory effect. What you see is that in that five-year period up to 1997, the income distribution was getting more unequal at quite a fast rate. Particularly the bottom decile were really losing out substantially. You know, these people were getting 2 or 3% less annual pay increase on average over that period than the people at the middle. People at the top did better than they do. And then the blue line is what happened immediately after the wage was, the 6 years after the wage was introduced. And you see an enormous increase for the bottom 10%, which quite quickly settles down. And then the people at the top continue to do better. And I give you the figure for the period from 2004 to 2010, just to show that even when the whole thing settled down, and most people are getting paid around them, the median increase, it's still the case that the bottom quintile is doing relatively well. And rather surprisingly, the top didn't. It's the top, you know, it's the top 1% who've done extraordinarily well in the past few years. So the minimum wage has had a big impact, and combined with, it's a necessary requirement if you're going to have effective in-work benefits given by the state, because otherwise employers just pay less knowing that workers get paid more in benefits. But if you introduce the minimum wage, there's a statistic produced by the Institute of Fiscal Studies last week, I think it was, showing that the proportion of children growing up in poverty, defined as the proportion in families with less than 60% of the median, diminished by about a third over that period from 98 to 2011. About a million fewer kids growing up in poverty. It's not perfect, but it's better than what was happening before, which was actually more and more was sinking rapidly into poverty. The trouble with minimum labour standards is that they do have really severe shortcomings, partly because they, however effective, they're necessarily geared to the weakest sectors. Because if you introduce a minimum wage that's really beefy, then you find a whole lot of, I don't know, laundries and newsagents and cafes and so on having to lay workers off. And the low-pay commission has always been driven above all by wanting to avoid creating unemployment. And it does nothing to extract a share of the rents, the profits, from the more prosperous sectors, which can then be, in some sense, by comparison, shared. And then the final thing is that minimum wage labour standards are difficult to enforce. This chap is a Ukrainian who was banged up for exploiting something like 400 mostly Ukrainian, mostly illegal immigrants about 5 or so years ago. He'll have finished his sentence and probably been kicked off back to Ukraine by now. But So people are, you know, it is implemented, but in most countries, the implementation of minimum wage is really lax, not least in China for very particular reasons. So minimum labour standards are necessary but not sufficient, however diligent you are in enforcing them. So the quest is really on for new sources of, I say, employer vulnerability. What I really mean is, you know, ways of making people who cornered the benefits of growing technologies, of you know, improving productivity and spreading them out. And so we get to the, as it were, the demand side. How do you organise customers? And here I think the first point is that reputational risk is a really important source of vulnerability. Measuring what proportion of their turnover companies spend on marketing is quite difficult. I want to do more on that. But Unilever spends about 10 to 15% of its total turnover on marketing. And marketing means brand names, and those who live by brand names can die by brand names. So keeping clean in the public eye becomes really important. And one thing that's completely without precedent, of course, in history is the extent to which people can communicate through the social media, through their little phones or whatever. And this is being widely used and can be used on, you know, whether it's campaigns against McDonald's or Hilfiger or whoever the people who are being picked out as obnoxious employers or sourcing from obnoxious employers. And just because there's so much subcontracting now, it means there are long, complex supply chains. And if you can find the right throttle points in supply chains with a brand name that you can expose, and the clearest ones are the supermarket chains like Walmart or Carrefour or whoever, then you can begin to get some sort of reaction if you are able to get evidence of bad labour practice. And the response on the management side is suddenly to discover corporate social responsibility as a phenomenon, sometimes called socially sustainable sourcing. And it's, of course, nothing to do with sudden outburst of being benign. It's got everything to do with trying to prevent reputational risk to your brand names and to your market. And so a number of institutions have developed to, in effect, police labour standards. This rather crude categorisation of four sorts. Private regulation, nearly all the supermarket chains and an awful lot of other organisations now pretty incessant in doing auditing. And if you look at a supermarket chain website, you'll see somewhere you can click which says corporate social responsibility, and if you're lucky, they'll publish the result of their last survey of their sources, which, you know, Walmart might have, I don't know, 3,000 to 4,000 factories in China they're sourcing from, and you'll see what proportion of them have failed to pass the test of how many water closets per 100 workers, or, you know, very, very mundane things, but it's mundane things that make life bearable. And there's an organisation called the Global Social Compliance Programme, which has been set up in the last couple, or no, 5 years, I suppose, by the big supermarket chains, Tesco, Walmart, Sainsbury's, Carrefour, etc., which sets out basic standards that you have to go by. Again, if you look at the websites, you'll find them all set out. It's really rather interesting. Enforcement is a problem. Enforcement is a problem particularly one back along the supply chain. It was a Walmart inspector who told me the depressing thing was that if you discovered a source factory that was really rather horrible in the way it treated its workers, and you said, we won't get the next contract from you unless you get your ways right, you go back to them in a year's time, and they look wonderful, but you find that they are importing 90% of their value added and just got a front, as it were, that looks all snow white and clean. Labelling systems. I find these interesting because it means that the consumers, at least middle-class consumers who can afford, have a sort of conscience notion that they're willing to pay a conscience premium, which fair trade internationally is one of the interesting ones. Labour behind the label is a more aggressive one in terms of workers' rights, and they're interested in, so they had, you know, this is just from their website, let's clean up fashion in 2011, and it's to do with sourcing from workplaces with rotten labour standards. Another sort of labour standard policing organisation are the multipartite systems. The most interesting one in Britain is the Ethical Trading Initiative, set up in conjunction by the TUC and the CBI and a lot of large organisations. Again, their website's interesting. And again, what they do is, in effect, they do audits. If you pay £5,000, you get an audit from Ethical Trading Initiative. And if you don't get an audit, then it's very hard to sell to one of the big supermarkets, through one of the supermarket chains. So I think their independence is quite good. Although, again, the office is there, so it's difficult how far you can chase up the supply chain back to your sources, particularly when it gets to, you know, where were the minerals mined and where were the fish fished from and so on. The American counterpart, the Fair Labour Association, which has been doing quite a lot in China recently with some success. And then finally, there are what they call IFAs, International Framework Agreements, which some of the world global union organisations, mostly based in Geneva, have been developing with multinational corporations, with varying degrees of success. The trade unions also have been trying this route, how to embarrass the employers into behaving well. I had a wonderful postdoc working with me last year who was based, funded by the Economic Social Research Council, based in the TUC, doing research exclusively on these. And the very different sorts of things where this sort of the embarrassment factor comes in. The Public and Civil Service Union put pressure by various means to get government to ensure that subcontractors working for government in facilities management, for instance in running air bases or whatever, had got union recognition. ASDA, which is a part of Walmart, so give all credit, has had a very interesting agreement with Unite, the union, on agreed standards in slaughterhouses, meat manufacturing, a lot of it around us in East Anglia, of course. Slaughterhouses are ghastly places, and the processing of meat is just unmentionable, and it employs a lot of immigrant labour. But these standards have become quite widespread and really quite important. UCAT, the Construction Workers Union, and one particular firm, which would rather I didn't mention it, which is a big managing contractor on power station construction sites, that sort of thing, where you have myriad, a cascade of contractors, they have an extraordinary agreement whereby the union convener of shop stewards, the sort of senior lay official on the site, is given inspection powers to make sure that subcontractors conform to the agreed standards. London Living Wage, which stands now at, what, about £8.60, I think, whereas the minimum wage is, I think, £6.08. The London Living Wage is being very widely used throughout London by Boris Johnson, not least, in his various manifestations, and most of the London universities and a lot of the large firms, as a result of a campaign by the Union Unison and an organisation called Citizens UK, which is an interesting non-union pressure group. The petrol tanker strike, which caused the government to have a few frights a couple of months back, was a very interesting case of the union using this very unique power to potentially cripple the economy to try to stop and succeed, I think, so far, although it's not quite clear what the terms are, so that the subcontractors who are used to ferry petrol around the country, so that they're on relatively decent minimum contracts. Some years ago, as part of their deal for continuing to fund the Labour Party, the TUC got the Labour Party to support a two-tier code whereby public sector contracts should adhere to certain labour standards, terminated by the Cameron coalition. And in Scotland and Wales, that in effect, that continues. There are mandatory codes for public sector sourcing in Scotland and in Wales which uphold labour standards, whether or not people are in trade unions, of course. But I have to say these are very weak, and there are huge problems, not just going back down supply chains. There are particular sectors you can get at because they can be electorally embarrassing, but there are other sectors which are almost untouchable, and enforcement is really difficult. So while having an impact on the demand side through consumers is gathering pace and has a number of interesting manifestations, it really isn't the answer. It's not going to bring about the levels of diminished inequalities of the 20th century. It may bring up the bottom a bit, and that's very useful, very good for the people who benefit, but it's not going to have a substantial effect to the great bulk of the broad question of inequality. So I end up with what's going to happen in the rest of the world. And China's really interesting because, of course, it's such a huge proportion of manufacturing now. It'll overtake America as the biggest economy quite soon. And it's politically, as they say, interesting. And they have a lot of strikes. This is the picture of... Measuring strikes in China is very difficult, but this is one reasonably reliable source. But what are called mass incidents, which were back in 1993, it's somewhere around 10,000 a year. By 2009, it's, according to this, it's something like 120,000. So a lot of strikes. And the normal way of dealing with them was, you know, send in some army trucks and pick up the organisers, and if they're unlucky, they end up in a forced labour camp, and you know, a lot of people in forced labour camps. This is increasingly seen as not a very acceptable way of doing it. So the Chinese have got really interested in ACAS and ACAS procedures, which is why I've been given flights to China quite a lot in the last few years, because they're really interested in how you improve conflict resolution. The trade unions are... They exist. There's a thing called the All China Federation of Trade Unions, but they're part of the party state, and they're very closely enmeshed with the state. There are no rights. Strikes aren't illegal, but there are no rights to organise, which is why people who organise strikes tend to end up in a forced labour camp, or at any rate with their job prospects impaired. Of course, there's massive rapid industrialisation and urbanisation. 10 million people a year still going into the cities from the countrysides, large, and the huge change in values, not least these people who move mostly young, under the age of 30. Their pay is increasing, but an inequality is increasing. A country with a lot of corruption and minimal income taxation is leading to steadily increasing inequalities. Anyone who's experienced traffic jams in Beijing knows that when you get a car, you get a big car, as a statement, and you mostly can't move at rush hour because the very big streets are totally blocked. And there's increasing industrial unrest, and it is yielding improved pay, and it's yielding improved pay partly because the government is forcing it to, because it's forcing employers to pay more. The latest, I think, three-year plan says that the minimum wage should be increased at 15% a year. And that's from I've got a student doing research on strikes, and what she says is that this is, in fact, being used as a guideline by employers. But I wonder if I can finish with a little story. And this is a bit like, what was it, the cook, the thief, his wife and her lover, or whatever it was. This is a local union official, the worker activist, the regional party boss, and I don't know, that's the thief, perhaps. But it's a very interesting dispute. In late May 2010, the Honda lock factory in Guangdong province had a strike. People came out on strike. There were no leaders, apparent, and Honda got very upset, and the local Guangdong provincial government, of whom he's a fairly senior member, he's Mr. Chung, she's Ms. Liang, and she's Ms. Li. She was called in initially, and She talked to the Japanese owners, and she talked to the local party people, and eventually the workers put forward their leader. This is Ms. Lee, who at that age is 19. And perhaps that's partly it, that she looked vulnerable. But she was very bright, and she actually got in touch with a journalist, and the journalist suggested they should contact a law professor at Renmin University, People's University in Beijing. And he went down and he did a mediation with these people. But the story is interesting because it says a lot of things. It says that there's a lot of unrest. The reason the strike was that the minimum wage was raised, but the company didn't raise wages by a proportionate amount. I mean, the workers didn't know the meaning of the minimum wage, but in a sense, they felt they were being shortchanged by the company. But it's very hard to get representation. So Ms. Lee was very vulnerable, and I think she's now gone on to higher education, actually, because someone spotted that she's a very together young person. Ms. Liang will go far, and she was... So there was a wave of disputes took place then, particularly in foreign-owned companies, where the workers felt they were less likely to get bashed up because it would be bad for foreign investment. Mr. Chung is really interesting. He played a very important part, and he came and talked at conferences like this one here in Beijing. But one thing he did, which I think really is another part of the story, is part of his area is Foxconn, where hundreds of thousands of workers make the contents of Apple computers. And the working conditions in Foxconn are generally dreadful, and pay is not much good. And I've had notes from extensive interviews with him about the working conditions and the whole way in which Foxconn runs things on a sort of military... It's a Taiwanese-owned company. It's hard to be impressed with Apple if they can allow the contents of their machines to get made by such an organisation. And that's what he thought. So shortly before we met at this event, and I've met him subsequently, he got a flight to San Francisco and appeared at Apple headquarters and said, look, these are the working conditions. In other words, he spotted the reputational risk. And it was the labour, what was it called, the American Labour Organisation, publicity organisation, that has really picked it up. And about 6 months ago, there were considerable demonstrations in the States against Apple using Foxconn, because shortly before that, 35 people had committed suicide at Foxconn. I don't know, in an organisation with hundreds of thousands of workers, whether that's a lot or not, but it got a lot of publicity. So in a way, these three individuals reflect the paradox of China at the moment, as it tries to work out in whatever way, I don't know, whether it's going to give workers rights to be elected, rights to be organised, whether the union will have rights to be independent of the party state. And then there's all sorts of layers, because different provincial relationships with the unions seem to vary, and there's considerable experimentation. But there's very intelligent people at the top, and they're thinking very hard about how to make all this work. So, back to the exam question, how might we protect the wages of the weak? I rather like this poster. It won't be by unions carrying on doing what they were doing. And USDAW, which at that time was seen as a completely limp union, this is back in the 1950s, completely ineffective, is now one of the few unions which is actually growing. Why is it growing? Because it has a close agreement with Tesco, which is the biggest private sector employer in Britain, so it's very much dependent on Tesco. I also like it because, you know, John is at his union meeting when wives get together. The great bulk of our store members are, of course, women. The majority of trade union members in Britain are women. So it's not by some old route. Private sector trade unions throughout the world won't be able to achieve much by strike action, for the reasons I've given. If their strikes are successful, the business just moves elsewhere, and they're left with members without a job and not much to show for it. But there are exceptions, you know, but by and large. As a result, public sector pay will lose out for normal people, because their pay is so dependent on emulation of the private sector. Governments can play a role with things like minimum wages. But it can only play a secondary role for the reasons I give, that you can raise the bottom, but it doesn't do much to the rest of the income distribution. And to be really... And if we are going into a depression, which looks increasingly likely in Europe and perhaps more broadly, then that was what provoked the sort of Keynesian New Deal in America policies that involved trade union recognition and strengthening of collective of workers. Although it wouldn't take that form for the reasons I've given, because it wouldn't work in the private sector. Consumer organisations will grow in significance, yes, but their influence will be very patchy. And I think it's a huge amount of how labour standards prosper in the world, how we stop becoming more and more unequal and stop having all the social dislocation that will be the result, depends on the spread of more or less democratic political systems. And, you know, that's perhaps rather a pessimistic conclusion. Thank you very much.
We have time for about 10 minutes of questions. There's a roving mic in the room because the event is being recorded. So if you would like to ask Willie a question, do put up your hand. The roving mic will come to you at the back there.
I was wondering whether you could give us a view on whether models like the John Lewis Partnership model. Sorry?
Can you say that again? I didn't catch it.
Yes. I was wondering whether you could give us a view on whether models like the John Lewis Partnership model has a role to play in protecting the wages of the weak.
Yes. John Lewis Partnership is very interesting, but it's very, very peculiar. There's a book by John Spedan Lewis about why he set it up. And at the beginning, he says this will be one of the bulwarks against communism, written about 1922. How many owners of companies are willing to give all the company to the employees? Very few. And in fact, I can't think of any other cases. So what's interesting about John Lewis Partnership, it's been so successful, and it led the retail industry in Britain by actually taking its workers seriously and training them and giving them careers and decent pay and so on. But it is unique because it requires those who own to hand over ownership. So wonderful by its uniqueness, and tragic by its uniqueness, actually, because it's such a model of what it could be done, but it requires people to do things that normally those who have property don't like doing.
I would agree that the John Lewis Partnership is extremely interesting, but isn't it also the possibility that virtually every company in the world now is owned via pension fund investments communally? And one of the issues is maybe the lack of attention to what they own by the intermediaries who hold those shares.
Well, it's a big if how you connect the two up. And my pension fund, which I'm going to start drawing from in October, I don't think they're going to come and ask me, is it ethical or right to invest in this company as opposed to that company? And how do you... It's taken an awful long time before shareholders have begun to challenge the ridiculous levels of pay that chief executives are paying each other. And they're feeling terribly fierce, and it's probably about as much as they can get away with. I don't know if you can think of a way of linking, you know, the person who in some sense owns the pension rights with the conduct of the people who generate the income. That would be great.
There's been quite a lot of discussion about regional wages recently, yeah, in relation the relationship between private sector and public sector. But what's your view on its impact upon the inequalities or within the country?
Yes, it's an interesting debate, and I suspect that and it will probably develop. Well, at the moment, it's all rather academic, because pay rises are so small or negative that even if you started moving towards differentiation, it would take a very long time for them. But generally, and we thought about this a lot on the Low Pay Commission, to put it rather simply, the variance of pay within regions is vastly greater than the variance of pay between regions. If you're employed making sandwiches or cleaning out restaurant ovens or something, you will be low paid wherever you are. I mean, just, you know, it's a dreadful jobs get dreadful pay. Whether you're in central London, in which case you're probably a Somali, or whether you're in, you know, Leeds or wherever. And you can see it in East Anglia, you know, the differences in pay between, say, Thetford and Cambridge or Great Yarmouth or wherever, and the variations are very considerable, huge within regions and much greater than on average between regions. So tinkering with minimum wages would have very little impact. When we used to go to Northern Ireland, which we did once a year on the Low Pay Commission, and visit firms and low payers and low paid, this was a thing often the employers said, why do we have to pay this ridiculously high minimum wage? At which point someone would say, calm down, cut the minimum wages, they might start cutting the benefits as well. And so politically it became very... In terms of government employment, yes, well, it's happening in a sort of insidious way. The prisons are an interesting case. The more prisons get privatised, the more they reflect local rates of pay. I deal closely with the fire services, who are not privatised at all, and they do have national rates of pay. And it's very interesting, you know, travelling around the country. There's clearly an anxiety that might happen, but they're in uniquely strong product market position, if you like, and fire strikes don't, you know, politically difficult things to deal with because people can die and you never, don't know where the fallout will be if they do. So I think there will be a lot of talk of regionalisation of pay, but I doubt if it gets much further, but I may be wrong.
Thank you. I realise the John Lewis example's exceptional, but do you believe there could be any future for cooperative or mutual forms of companies having an effect in trying to protect the wages of the weak? I know they have a somewhat bad, well, for some people they have something of a bad reputation because the state attempts to create cooperatives in the 70s, but there's still a significant chunk of financial services and such like in this country. So, or do you think it's just that kind of movement is something that's had its day?
Well, there's a lot of experimentation in the 70s, yes, and a lot of studies. And you get, as it might be, worker cooperatives farming in Mahuntlas or something, which, where there's a small number of people and a fairly flat hierarchy. The worker cooperatives that work rather well, actually, are symphony orchestras. A lot of the symphony orchestras are... in some sense, owned. Vienna State, when they elected Mahler as their leader, that was a worker cooperative. London Symphony Orchestra, I think the RPO is too. When you have a sort of high independence of skills and a relatively equal level of skills, you can see why there's a dynamic that it actually works quite well. But in many organisations, and when they get large, it tends to break down. They think all the Scott Barda partnership got a lot of attention. There's a whole list of cooperatives one could go through which have been studied by academics in the 70s and 80s. But it's hard to see them developing. I mean, lawyers, they're quite a lot of professionals, but then they've got a pretty stitched-up market anyway, and they have government support of their licence, which means that, in effect, they're like old-fashioned craft unions. They've stitched up the market with government support, so they're a bit exceptional.
You've talked a little bit, Professor Brown, on the sort of the widening of the equalities gap. I just wondered on that, when you look at a macro level, there's two other arguments that are run alongside, aren't there, which is... the gap is widening, but that's not necessarily that the poor are getting poorer, it's that the rich are getting richer. So at one level, there's a sort of, there's an argument by the entrepreneurs, there's a level of protection. And secondly, if you look at the India and China's, there's a greater percentage of the population of the workforce, which is perhaps richer than they ever were, i.e. there have been avenues of facilities for those on lower wages to have access to higher wages. Now, a lot of the arguments of that and why that's happening is to do with the fact that if you leave external markets to work in a sort of private enterprise way, then what you will get is exactly what you've said, new technology, new ways of working, and therefore new accessibility for individuals to access work in a different way than they have previously. So I just wondered whether, within the sort of examples you've put, whether there is a role for the free market and how it behaves in the future to also provide accessibility for pay to be self-controlling.
I'm not sure what people mean by free market. That's one of my problems. And some of the countries which coped best with the ups and downs of world inflation in the 70s and 80s and 90s were ones which had got, in effect, a social partnership deal to ride out. You know, Scandinavian countries, Austria most notably. And that was because they stitched up the market. I mean, the notion of a free market is a very odd notion. And because you compete usually by breaking the rules, by producing a better product or, you know, whatever it might be. The danger is that if there's no constraint, a society can tear itself apart just by becoming so unequal that it lacks all coherence, I think. And I'd have thought that there are a number of cases of that in history. I don't think I can give you a very helpful answer, Andy.
Thank you. I fully accept the importance of raising the living standards of the poorest, but I do wonder whether it's wise to be fearful of inequality as a measure. If I may take the Cambridge sub-regional economy as a model, I think if you compared the Cambridge sub-region with that of King's Lynn, for example, I think we would probably be statistically a much more unequal society in Cambridge, not because the poorest are worse off, indeed they're probably better off than in King's Lynn, but because the extraordinary economic phenomenon, the Cambridge phenomenon, has produced hundreds of millionaires, including some individuals who've made hundreds of millions out of the wonderful companies that they've produced. Now, it seems to me all of that activity and the creation of all those very wealthy people has been nothing but good for the economy of Cambridge and the economy of the country. And I agree that if a kind of jealousy sets in where people say, oh, it's horrible that Mike Lynch should have made 500 million, that can be destructive. But I mean, I personally think people ought to celebrate Mike Lynch making his 500 million. And I do worry that if we get into a mentality of saying, sort of, you know, we must drive down inequality, the whole economy may suffer, because I would have thought, you know, the kind of economy we've got here in Cambridge is exactly the sort of economy that needs to be developed across the whole country if we're to prosper in the future.
Well, I agree with you completely. And many of the students from my college, Darwin College, go on to form just that sort of company. The difficulty, I think, is firstly, there's a matter of extreme. You know, why is it that Martin Sorrell gets grumpy if he's not given £8 million a year when, you know, 10, 15, 20 years ago, people got all upset when the guy who's head of British Gas got 400,000. And the scale of inequality has increased massively. But the problem, I think, is a deeper one, and it's to do with giving people hope in a way. Social mobility in Britain is declining. Intergenerational transmission of wealth is getting more locked in. You know, you pass on to children, you buy more expensive education. Why? Because that buys them into Cambridge or wherever. Because there's no correlation between wealth and intelligence, as everyone knows. You see that in Cambridge, certainly. So, yes, I see nothing wrong with that sort of society. But with a society where the rich can get richer. But unless there's some trickle-down mechanism whereby the poor can maintain some sort of dignity of living and dignity of life and give their children some sort of prospects. It's very interesting, if you look back at the 1890s in New Zealand and Australia, where it started, or in Britain, where it came, that the pressure to have a minimum wage, it very largely came from the observation that children growing up in poverty become a burden on the state. They turn to crime, they have ill health and all the rest of it. And that was what, as much as anything, triggered the coming of the minimum wage in Britain in the 1990s. the proportion of children growing up in proportion of households with children getting less than 60% of the household median was around 20% all through the 40s, 50s and 60s, and it rose in the 80s to over 30%. And that was one of the triggers. So the question is, and if you can give me the recipe for a society where, yes, people can flourish and get world, in some sense, world-class incomes because they're in world markets, but at the same time, the great, you know, high proportion of the population, the children aren't growing up with no hope, no chance of hope. That's the problem. And that's why kids, 10 months ago, burnt down the centres of cities. They had no prospects. So how long can you get a society like that to go unless you just have sort of enclosed communities for the rich and a lot of police cruising around the streets? I don't think that's a society any of us want.
I know we could continue talking about these very major issues all evening. You're already, however, out of time, beyond time. Other people put their hands up, but I'm sure that these are issues which are not going to go away as society faces a major depression. I know Rebecca will want to be giving a vote of thanks, but could I just say, really, how much I enjoyed that. The reason I became an economic historian was somebody who is now not much thought about, R.H. Tawney.
Yes.
And R.H. Tawney, I think, spirit hovered in the room, because yes, he started out his life in adult education. He went on to write about the trade boards in 1908. He worked on education and the sort of social mobility you're talking about, and he wrote that great book, Equality. So
I should say, perhaps, that my father was a professor of economics in Leeds, and several times R.H. Tawney came to stay because he'd come to talk to the local. So I remember this.
I'm delighted to see that the spirit of R.H. Tawney
is right
reincarnated in Professor Brown. So thank you very much.
Martin, for chairing and for those very appropriate comments to close. And of course, thank you, Willie, for an incredibly thought-provoking lecture this evening. We have a small gift for you, just a token of our appreciation, which is a guide of the hall and the gardens and some of the history about the place here. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Of course, thanks also to colleagues for helping with arrangements this evening. And just in closing, I'd like to say that I hope that we'll see many of you back here at Madingley Hall in future, whether that be for Madingley lectures in future or Madingley concerts, or indeed studying with us. You'll notice that on all of your chairs there are brochures of the courses that we offer here at the Institute of Continuing Education, and there are further brochures for other sorts of our courses on the gallery. Please do take them away with you, browse them, pass them on, and so on. Our next Madingley lecture is on the 8th of October, and that will be Professor Andrew Barmford, Professor of Conservation Science here at the University, who will speak on nature's glass, half full or half empty. And you'd be very welcome to join us back here at Madingley Hall then in October. So thank you and good evening. It's a beautiful evening, so if you'd like to explore the gardens, please do before you head home. Unless you have an official invite, in which I could suggest, in which case, if you could gather here and then we will move on to a subsequent room. So thank you very much and good evening.